Hello, and welcome to another episode of Exiting the Cave, Short Reads. This week we continue with the Consolation of Philosophy, and in Book 3, Chapter 9, we're moving on to the first in a few dialogues on God and true happiness. You'll want to sit back and close your eyes for this one. Lady Philosophy is about to take you for a ride. Enjoy! This much may well suffice to set forth the form of false happiness. If this is now clear to thine eyes, the next step is to show what true happiness is.
Indeed, said I. I see clearly enough that neither is independence to be found in wealth, nor power and sovereignty, nor reverence in dignities, nor fame and glory, nor true joy in pleasures.
Hast thou discerned also the causes why this is so?
I seem to have some inkling, but I should like to learn more at large from thee.
Why, truly the reason is hard at hand. That which is simple and indivisible by nature, human error separates and transforms from the true and perfect to the false and imperfect. Dost thou imagine that which lacketh nothing can want power?
Certainly not.
Right. For if there is any feebleness of strength in anything, in this there must necessarily be need of external protection.
That is so.
Accordingly, the nature of independence and power is one and the same.
It seems so.
Well, but dost think that anything of such a nature as this can be looked upon with contempt, or is it rather of all things most worthy of veneration?
Nay, there can be no doubt as to that.
Let us then add reverence to independence and power, and conclude these three to be one.
We must, if we will acknowledge the truth.
Thinkest thou, then, this combination of qualities to be obscure and without distinction, or rather famous in all renown? Just consider. Can that want renown which has been agreed to be lacking in nothing, to be supreme in power, and right worthy of honor, for the reason that it cannot bestow this upon itself, and so comes to appear somewhat poor in esteem?
I cannot but acknowledge that, being what it is, this union of qualities is also right famous.
It follows, then, that we must admit that renown is not different from the other three.
It does, said I.
That, then, which needs nothing outside itself, which can accomplish all things in its own strength, which enjoys fame and compels reverence. Must not this evidently be also fully crowned with joy?
In sooth, I cannot conceive, said I, how any sadness can find entrance into such a state. Wherefore I must needs acknowledge it is full of joy, at least if our former conclusions are to hold.
Then, for the same reasons, this also is necessary, that independence, power, renown, reverence, and sweetness of delight are different only in name, but in substance differ nowise from one another.
It is, I said.
This, then, which is one and simple by nature, human perversity separates, and in trying to win a part of that which has no parts, fails to attain not only that portion, since there are no portions, but also the whole to which it does not dream of aspiring.
How so? Said I.
He who, to escape want, seeks riches, gives himself no concern about power. He prefers a mean and low estate, and also denies himself many pleasures dear to nature to avoid losing the money which he has gained. But at this rate, he does not even attain to independence, a weakling void of strength, vexed of distresses, mean and despised, and buried in obscurity. He again, who thirsts alone for power, squanders his wealth, despises pleasures, and thinks fame and rank alike worthless without power. But thou seest in how many ways his estate also is defective. Sometimes it happens that he lacks necessaries, that he is gnawed by anxieties, and since he cannot rid himself of these inconveniences,
even ceases to have that power which was his whole end and aim. In like manner, may we cast up the reckoning in case of rank, of glory, or of pleasure. For since each one of these severally is identical with the rest, whosoever seeks any one of them without the others does not even lay hold of that one which he makes his aim.
Well, said I, what then?
Suppose any one desire to obtain them together. He does indeed wish for happiness as a whole, but will he find it in these things which, as we have proved, are unable to bestow what they promise?
Nay, by no means, said I.
Then happiness must certainly not be sought in these things which severally are believed to afford some one of the blessings most to be desired.
They must not, I admit. No conclusion could be more true.
So then, the form and causes of false happiness are set before thine eyes. Now, turn thy gaze to the other side. There thou wilt straightway see the true happiness I promised.
Yea, indeed, 'tis plain to the blind, said I. Thou didst point it out even now in seeking to unfold the causes of the false. For unless I am mistaken, that is true and perfect happiness which crowns one with the union of independence, power, reverence, renown, and joy. And to prove to thee, with how deep an insight I have listened, since all these are the same, that which can truly bestow one of them, I know to be without doubt full and complete happiness.
Happy thou art, my scholar, in this thy conviction. Only one thing shouldst thou add.
What is that? Said I.
Is there aught, thinkest thou, amidst these mortal and perishable things, which can produce a state such as this?
Nay, surely not. And this thou hast so amply demonstrated that no word more is needed.
Well then, these things seem to give to mortals shadows of the true good, or some kind of imperfect good, but the true and perfect good they cannot bestow.
Even so, said I.
Since then thou hast learnt what that true happiness is, and what men falsely call happiness, it now remains that thou shouldst learn from what source to seek this.
Yes, to this I have long been eagerly looking forward.
Well, since, as Plato maintains in the Timaeus, we ought even in the most trivial matters to implore the divine protection, what thinkest thou should we now do in order to deserve to find the seat of that highest good?
We must invoke the Father of all things, said I, for without this no enterprise sets out from a right beginning.
Thou sayest well, said she,
and forthwith lifted up her voice and sang.
Maker of earth and sky, from age to age who rules the world by reason, at whose word time issues from eternity's abyss. To all that moves, the source of movement, fixed thyself and moveless. Thee no cause impelled extrinsic this proportioned frame to shape from shapeless matter, but deep set within thy inmost being, the form of perfect good from envy free. And thou didst mold the whole to that supernal pattern. Beauteous, the world in thee thus imagined, being thyself most beautiful. So thou the work didst fashion in that fair likeness, bidding it put on perfection through the exquisite perfectedness of every part's contrivance. Thou dost bind the elements in balanced harmony, so that the hot and cold, the moist and dry, contend not, nor the pure fire leaping up escape, or weight of waters whelm the earth. Thou joinest and diffusest through the whole, linking accordingly its several parts, a soul of threefold nature, moving all. This, cleft in twain, and in two circles gathered, speeds in a path that on itself returns, encompassing mind's limits, and conforming the heavens to her true semblance. Lesser souls and lesser lives by a like ordinance thou sendest forth, each to its starry car affixing, and dost strew them far and wide o'er earth and heaven. These by a law benign thou biddest turn again and render back to thee their fires. O grant, Almighty Father, grant us on reason's wing to soar aloft to heaven's exalted height. Grant us to see the fount of good. Grant us the true light found, to fix our steadfast eyes and vision clear on thee. Disperse the heavy mists of earth and shine in thine own splendor. For thou art the true serenity and perfect rest of every pious soul. To see thy face, the end and the beginning. One, the guide, the traveler, the pathway, and the goal. So, after one final exchange between Lady Philosophy and Boethius on the imperfection of earthly pursuits, Lady Philosophy coaxes us to take a deep dive into the Timaeus. She names it explicitly, directing Boethius to invoke the Father of all things for divine protection. Here's the passage from the Timaeus she was referring to. Socrates.
I see that I shall receive in my turn a perfect and splendid feast of reason. And now, Timaeus, you, I suppose, should speak next, after duly calling upon God.
Timaeus.
All men, Socrates, who have any degree of right feeling at the beginning of every enterprise, whether small or great, always call upon God. And we, too, who are going to discourse of the nature of the universe, how created or how existing without creation, if we be not altogether out of our wits, must invoke the aid of God and pray that our words may be acceptable to Him and consistent with themselves. Let this then be our invocation of God, to which I add an exhortation of myself, to speak in such a manner as will be most intelligible to you and will most accord with my own intent.
At this point in the dialogue, Timaeus then begins a syllogistic argument for the fact of creation from a perfect cause. I'm not going to rehearse that argument here because it's lengthy and slightly off point, but what matters for our purposes is the difference between the nature of God and the nature of the created universe. And on that, Timaeus has this to say.
The work of the Creator, whether he looks to the unchangeable and fashions the form and nature of his work after an unchangeable pattern, must necessarily be made fair and perfect. But when he looks to the created only and uses a created pattern, it is not fair or perfect. Which of the patterns had the artificer in view when he made the world? The pattern of the unchangeable, or of that which is created? If the world be indeed fair and the artificer good, it is manifest that he must have looked to that which is eternal. But if what cannot be said without blasphemy is true, then to the created pattern. Everyone will see that he must have looked to the eternal, for the world is the fairest of creations, and he is the best of causes. And having been created in this way, the world has been framed in the likeness of that which is apprehended by reason and mind, and is unchangeable, and must therefore, of necessity, if this is admitted, be a copy of something good. God desired that all things should be good and nothing bad, so far as this was attainable. Wherefore, also finding the whole visible sphere not at rest, but moving in an irregular and disorderly fashion, out of disorder he brought order, considering that this was in every way better than the other.
The key point here for Timaeus is to emphasize the difference between the immanent material world and the transcendent eternal world, and to explain how the Creator, who is unmoving and perfectly complete, could have created a universe that is something less than that, and to tell a story about what he did to fix it. This part of the dialogue frames in lofty mystical terms the central conundrum of all philosophy, reconciling the one and the many, marrying plurality with unity, and bridging the gap between the immanent and the transcendent. This is a philosophical debate that will rage for as long as mankind exists on Earth, and in some ways, it's a debate that cannot be resolved. It can only ever be illustrated by myth, theology, and speculation. It defies a material explanation because it precedes the methods of material explanation. As Timaeus himself puts it, "The Father and Maker of all this universe is past finding out. And even if we found him, to tell of him to all men would be impossible." Which is why I think the verse in this chapter of the Consolation is far more important than the prose. You'll recall that Lady Philosophy herself hints at this in the exchange with Boethius on the attainability of the perfect good. She tells Boethius, by way of a question, that amid mortal and perishable things, no such state as perfect happiness is possible, and that the things we think it to be are shadows of the true good. The reference to shadows is significant here. This is actually Boethius' second reference to Plato's famous allegory of the cave found in the Republic. The first came just a few paragraphs earlier when Lady Philosophy directed Boethius to turn thy gaze to the other side. In the allegory of the cave, the unshackled man famously has to turn his face to the light of the sun after reaching the cave's exit.
"He will require to grow accustomed to the sight of the upper world. And first he will see the shadows best, next the reflections of men and other objects in the water, and then the objects themselves. Then he will gaze upon the light of the moon and the stars and the spangled heaven. And then he will see the sky and the stars by night better than the sun or the light of the sun by day. Last of all, he will be able to see the sun, and not mere reflections of him in the water, but he will see him on his own proper place, and not in another, and he will contemplate him as he is."
It is instructive to note that, in dramatic order, the Timaeus comes directly after the Republic. Socrates decides to rest in the evening after his dialogue with Glaucon and Adeimantus to listen to Timaeus give this account of creation and the transcendent realm. Boethius is telling his readers that they've reached the mouth of the cave. Finally, recall that Lady Philosophy made reference to a soul of threefold nature moving all in the verse. This may catch some Christians off guard. Boethius here is not referring to the Trinity of Catholic dogma. Rather, he is again referencing Timaeus. Timaeus explains,
"The Creator, reflecting on the things which are by nature visible, found that no unintelligent creature taken as a whole was fairer than the intelligent taken as a whole, and that intelligence could not be present in anything which was devoid of soul. For which reason, when he was framing the universe, he put intelligence in soul and soul in body, that he might be the creator of a work which was by nature fairest and best. Wherefore, we may say that the world became a living creature truly endowed with soul and intelligence by the providence of God."
This is an incredibly important passage in the Timaeus, in my view. Intelligibility and order are the two features of the universe that no good philosopher can ignore honestly, and they are the two facts of reality that keep me coming back to a belief in God. But this will have to be a discussion for another podcast. Rather, the point here is twofold. First, the threefold nature is a creature who is ensouled, intelligent, and visible. In other words, God made a universe which is itself a living being that is like him in some fundamental way. Its order encompassing mind's limit, as the verse put it. Second, notice how there has been a shift in focus in this chapter. Until now, we were on a hunt for what was true, and then what was good. Now we're judging everything by a standard of its fairness. In other words, beauty. So in addition to reaching the exit of Plato's cave, we've also attained to all three of the transcendent forms, truth, goodness, and beauty. And arguably, given where this was put in the course of the consolation, one might say it is the master value for Boethius, although that's debatable. There is so much more that could be said about this chapter, but I'm afraid I have to park those topics for another time. Perhaps I'll leave them for you to explore on your own. Next week, we soar even higher and contemplate the nature of God's absolute goodness, his relation to true happiness, the possibility of theosis, and take a brief detour into divine simplicity at Lady Philosophy's prompting. Stay tuned!